Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. We're here to empower people, and today you're going to learn a great deal more about curcumin than what you probably have in the past. I'm going to do a little classroom on the air. I'm going to talk about how curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, reverses the cellular damage of chronic stress. Now think of the importance of that. Everybody has stress, but not everyone responds in the same way. Some people in a negative way, others, well, they don't personalize it. They don't feel that somehow everything today was going to go bad and you're the target. So I'm going to share some unique insights from Amy Johnson on that. Then, if you use a computer or smartphone, you'll definitely want to hear what I have to say about the newest research on these electronic devices. And then we're going to take a look at tocotrienols. Now, this is, you've heard of tocopherols like vitamin E, but tocotrienols are a subfraction of that. There's new research on how it can combat cancers. And then from, and these are all university-based studies, and then from Sao Paulo University in Brazil, eating more polyunsaturated fats is linked to turning off inflammation if you have a heart condition. I talked briefly about that yesterday and how not all fats are the same, and that those who are trying to discourage us from using, let's say, olive oil or, and I'm going to list the companies that have been found by independent assay to be adulterating or having purchased, and I'm assuming this was innocent on their part. They just unfortunately didn't do an analysis to see from Italy if it was legitimate or not, but the legitimate olive oils and the non-legitimate olive oils. But they, some people in the scientific community would like us to believe that we should not eat coconut oil. Well, we should. They're wrong. And they're wrong on the science. But don't Google coconut oil. Google the different fatty acids in coconut oil and do all these scientific studies pop up. So I'll tell you more about the oils you should consume. So that's just part of what we're going to talk about on health and healing. Then I'm going to do a brief commentary from Henry Giroux about why we should take another look at our educational system. I'll be sharing my own commentary on that. And this came to me because of a headline from a local newspaper. And it's entitled, Principal Gives Teenagers Who Cut Class an Easy Pass. Well, when I was going to high school or college, if you cut a class and you failed because you didn't know what you were doing, got a lower grade, that's what you earned. That's what you deserve. If you wanted special help, you asked for it and you were given it. Today, you don't have to go to class. You could actually get a college degree without ever attending a single class. Think not. As a teacher at a respected university, I can tell you that's absolutely the case. In fact, I quit the university when the dean told me I had to pass the class. I passed the two students who sat outside the class, never attended class, mocked the other students in class. I had a discussion with the students. How do you feel when two of your colleagues are out there and they're not coming to class and you are? And they were angry about it. And yet these two got away with it. How do we have a system that is so corrupt, so vile, so perverse that we're allowing this to happen? I'll give my commentary on that. And then, what did George Carlin have to say about Democrats and Republicans? Well, today we'll give you a short four-minute version, starting with Republicans. On another day, Democrats. And I think George Carlin is one of those unique American comedians who can weave a lot of social issues into a short commentary. But I'm saving most of my program today for our guest in the second part. My guest is Professor Kiran Klaus Patel. He is the Jean Monnet Professor of European and Global History at one of the most respected universities in the Netherlands, Maastricht. And he is also a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. specializing in the history of President Roosevelt's New Deal and the Great Depression and the history of labor in Nazi Germany. So we're going to have an interesting discussion about the global dimensions of FDR's New Deal and its impact upon America's role in the world today. I believe we have to take a step back and look at what worked and did not work historically in order to go forward and have a more honest view of our condition. And also today, if time permits, I'm going to be addressing some of the questions that you have raised, and you can go to prnstudio@gmail.com and list your questions. Any question or comment you'd like, if it's something we can all benefit from the answer, if it's something that empowers us by your comments, I'm happy to share it. Negative? No. We have enough negativity in the world. I like to focus upon solutions that are positive and constructive. So I'm going to take some of those questions, and I like to take the ones that are more challenging. I like the tougher questions to address. So that's what we have. Let's get into it. I believe that curcumin is one of the single most important nutrients you can take into your body. I've seen what it does in combination with a lifestyle change, diet, exercise, stress management. But I've also seen what it does when it's excluded, and that's why I include it. And we know, for example, that it helps with cancer. It can change the chemicals that are defective against DNA. It can help clean up our blood. It's great for preventing heart disease. But there's something it does that no one talks about. And yet the literature is there. It deals with stress. In some ways, I feel like my life kind of mirrors a different type of Forrest Gump. I was very young, not very bright, naive, but I had the ability to listen to wiser people, learn from that, and see if in my own way, using nothing more than common sense and simple reason, could I apply the principles of some of those great minds that I had encountered early in life to make sense of this world I live in and help share that with other people. And one of the people I met early in my career was the father of stress therapy. I mean, you go back in the literature, you find Dr. Lawrence LeShan. I work with him at the Institute of Biology. Great mind. And by the way, just to let you know, he was the first person to be able to say and scientifically verify that just by interviewing you, if you had no cancer in your history at all, no aunt, no niece, mother, grandmother, he could determine at a high level of probability if you developed cancer based solely upon whether you felt you were unappreciated or neglected of love. And those were some very important seminal studies. Later, there was a Dr. Gerald, who was the chief psychiatrist in the medical officers in New York City. I had many conversations with him, and he did some pioneering, very important work on determining other illnesses you could develop based upon whether or not you were being respected or neglected. But Dr. Hans Selye was the progenitor. He was the one, just like Rachel Carson with Silent Spring, he was the one who stepped up and gave us a whole new understanding that stress is not a single entity. You have to break stress down into its components. Now, it's more complicated than this, but I'll give you the lay, simple version. Look at stress as either being constructive or destructive. Things that excite us, that we're impassioned by, that we're looking forward to, that we want to be a part of, that type of stress excites us. When you're going to, for example, to get married or on your honeymoon or you're having a child, a planned child, and that's all good stress. That does not stimulate the negative hormones. And he was the father of hormone therapy when it came to understanding distress. Now, the other part of stress that is harmful, the one that impacts most of us, is distress. And that's where distress causes our hormones, the negative ones, cortisol in particular, to be elevated. And he said if we cannot accordingly change our approach to distress, it will really negatively impact us. And in several conversations we had, because I wanted to know more about it, because where I came from, most people either got very angry when they were stressed, or you never heard them say anything. They held it inside. But holding something inside doesn't mean that it's neutral, that it's non-harmful. It means it's eating you up inside. And hence, you could lock that stress into your first chakra, your lower area, your reproductive area, your bowel area, and you end up with constipation, end up with inability to have any pleasure sexually because you're holding your energy there or other people's energies there. I have found that, I don't have time today to get into it, but at some upcoming webinar, I'll talk about why so many people have so many problems with enjoying their own sex because of other people's energy in them, literally in them, and how that happens, and then how that, in effect, turns a lock on. And that lock keeps the DNA from being able to even experience pleasure, even when there's a desire for pleasure. But in any case, it can happen elsewhere. It chokes you up in the where you can't breathe. So every time you get distressed, it manifests in your lungs. So other people could be in their headache. It could be in a migraine. It could be in brain fog. So distress is really bad. So the idea is, are you able to let things go? Just let it go. Say it's okay. Because we all should know that no matter what has happened wrong in our life, we can't change it. I use this as an analogy to make the point. Let's just say one day you were angry about something, you were out of sorts, and so you said something that was really inappropriate to someone in your life, something that was calculated to make the other person feel bad about themselves. And almost always we only say these things to people we know we can get away with it, which in itself is negative, because the people who are closest to us are the people we should cherish most and be most sensitive to, not going out of our way to try to make them feel bad or unworthy or unlovable or negative or toxic. So in any case, what I found was, let's just say you say something wrong and visualize that as a mirror breaking, a hand mirror, what you said. It hurts the other person, and maybe they don't know how to respond. Maybe they don't respond. Maybe they've been yelled at and given negative impressions so often, they just feel battered. It's as if they're a prisoner on a chair with their arms tied behind their back, and they have no choice but look at you like you're just smacking them from one side to the other because you're angry at them. Something in your life didn't go well. You're projecting upon them, and that's the only tool you have. So no matter how many times you say you're sorry, it doesn't change a damn thing. Sorry has never changed anything in history, period. Why? Look at the mirror. Let's say you're sorry, really, really sorry. So you get down and you cry over that mirror and all of its broken pieces, and you pray to that mirror. You'll never do it again, so help you God. And, you know, you really don't want that person to be hurt. Now ask yourself, how many times have you seen a broken mirror heal itself and come back together? Never has, never will. So let's just get one thing in our consciousness. When you act out and you use de-stress, inappropriate behavior upon yourself or anyone else, it can never be undone. I don't care if you go to 1,000 years of stupid psycho-fraud, psychotherapy, you're not going to change a damn thing. You may be better educated as to why you did it. You can discuss that forever. It doesn't change what you did. That doesn't mean we should hang on to it. We shouldn't. The right way is just to turn around and say, okay, I don't like what you did. I don't like what you said. I don't like how I feel about it, but I'm going forward. And you're not coming with me. I'm not going to give you another chance because I have this thing I called the magic number. What is the magic number of times you're going to allow yourself to be used, abused? What is it? Let's say you're in a marriage and you find out your spouse has cheated on you. How many more times should you allow that? 2, 20, 300, 10,000, infinity. because that tells you a lot about yourself, not the other person. Why do we stay in negative situations? Why do we tolerate abuse? Why do we tolerate other people abusing us? Well, I believe the magic number should be zero. If you can't respect the people you're with, then stay away from them. If people can't respect you, stay away from them. That's a radical concept because we're supposed to feel sorry for the person abusing us as if we all have Stockholm Syndrome. Sorry, it doesn't work. So now we get to the point that really is important. So now you don't know how to deal with stress. Almost no one does, by the way. 99% of the people I've ever met in my life, no matter what happens, their conditioned epigenetic response lashes out. And then later they say, well, you know, I shouldn't have said that, shouldn't have done that. Okay, fine. Now apologize. What good does your apology do? You didn't learn anything. You're going to do it again. And that's the problem. Everybody just keeps this damn doing it again, doing it again, doing it again. And so it's not about them. It's about you. So what can you do? Well, there are a couple things you can do that are very constructive. One, I suggest just stop all this crazy stupidness around people who shouldn't be in your life and just walk away. If they can't get the lesson, it's not you to teach them by allowing yourself to be their doormat where they're wiping their feet on you, they're smacking you verbally or physically or betraying you. It's for you to walk away and look for people to put in your life who respect you, honor you as the wonderful person you are. But you got to do more than that. And here's where stress that becomes distress can cause destructive changes to your brain. Now, while we may feel anxious due to stress, those feelings are minor compared to damage done in our brain cells. Stress-induced brain changes often lead to anxiety and depression and worse. Almost the vast majority of people who are suffering from depression and anxiety have first suffered from stress and are suffering now from stress-induced brain damage. And yet we were never told, get angry, scream at someone, and you're going to hurt your brain. Your brain. Forget about anyone else's. Your brain's the one. So the person who is angry is the person who's hurting their own brain. The trouble is a lot of this is going to be irreversible at some point in the future, unless you know about curcumin. Now, curcumin is a polyphenol derived from turmeric, a spice, and it can actually reverse. Listen to what I'm saying. It can reverse harmful brain changes induced by chronic stress, or what we call distress. Why? Because it has the power to form new brain cells and their connections, two processes that can prevent or mitigate symptoms of depression. And curcumin has been used for at least 4,000 years to treat and prevent various illnesses. And new studies show that it can help protect mental health by combating stress-induced anxiety and depression. And I'm just going to take a few moments. I'm taking longer on this because it's our classroom on the air, and I like to take more time to go into greater depth. But there are many studies that show that human trials demonstrating the ability of curcumin to mitigate the adverse impact of stress on mental and physical health. So here's how you can control distress at the cellular level, or if you've been abused by someone who is using you as their target for their anger and rage and animus. We now know through good scientific research that emotional or psychological stress negatively impacts our physical body, not just the brain. And studies demonstrate a close relationship between psychological stress and physical damage effects. For example, we've seen in studies where a stress can mimic the kinds of chronic, unpredicted, stressful events that happen in our daily lives but manifest in our body. The exhaustion of our adrenal glands, in particular, making them far more susceptible to the negative effects of cortisol, the elevation in blood levels of cortisol, are shown to be killers. They really hurt us. And at the cellular level, stress inhibits our natural antioxidant systems, promotes oxidative damage, which prematurely ages you, speeds up telomere shortening, and injures the energy-producing structures inside the mitochondria. This is where the adenosine triphosphate, where you actually create energy, it interferes with that. And as a result, people who are stressed, depressed, and anxious are frequently fatigued. In addition, stressed in laboratory studies impact performance and memory and cognitive defects are accorded. And chronic unpredictable stress adversely affects production of brain protective compounds. And hence you can alter your mental behavior to the negative with stressful situations. But in comes curcumin. It reverses these damaging changes in the body's physical system. And when given orally, curcumin has been shown to restore the cortisol balance and adrenal glands to their normal function and to normalize behavior in both laboratory studies and in humans. So, by protecting cellular structures from physical damage, curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, is able to help to mediate the longer-term impacts of stress, like chronic anxiety and depression. And by the way, if you're anxious, studies have shown that taking oral curcumin can significantly prevent anxiety behaviors and improve mobility and effects that are triggered by acute stressors such as sleep deprivation or restraints. So, just very important. Just want to make sure, because we're all faced with stressors and we do not help ourselves if we absorb other people's anger, allow ourselves to be walked upon, we can walk away. Do not engage. Do not scream back. Do not fight back, because then both of you, if you looked at a universal Gaia mirror of two people screaming at each other, visualize, turn off the sound so you can't hear them screaming, but they're both holding forks and stabbing every point of their body with that fork. So everything they're saying, they're stabbing themselves. Now, if you have a smartphone, there was a PR Newswire release, and most people listening right now have had a electronic device, that 80% of the population in the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and other European countries had internet connection, according to the latest research. And while some people use computers or smartphones to check email and social media sites, others, well, their livelihood depends upon it. Spending 8 or more hours in front of a computer for 5 days in a row creates a lot of problems. It damages your eyes, and in really bad ways. And it's just like if you're around the LEDs, light-emitting diodes, they emit about 35% blue light, and that is very harmful to your body. This was published in the Review of Optometry. So our exposure to blue light emanating from our portable listening devices, our computers, our laptops, induces photochemical stress that damages cells in the eye's retina, which can lead to their destruction. And just so you know, the retina is a nerve cell layer in the back of the eye that contains neurons known as photoreceptors. Those are the rods and the cones that sense light, resulting in impulses that are transmitted via the optic nerve to the brain. And the retinal pigment epithelium is a layer of pigmented cells next to and outside the retina that nourishes retinal nerve tissue and transport molecules into the retina and out of it. So you have a lot of carotenoids, lutein, zeaxanthin, mesothelin. These pigments have been characterized as forming kind of biological sunglasses that absorb blue light. Therefore, the more of the lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, and zeaxanthin, Z-E-A-X-A-N-T-H-I-N, that accumulate in the macula, the more protected it is. So if you're around a computer, you're using any of these portable devices, make sure that you're having lots of vegetable juices, eating colorful fruits, taking your vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc. They all help protect your eyes. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, tocotrienols. Tocos, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I, enols, E-N-O-L-S, tocotrienols. And the latest studies show that, with a recent discovery by scientists, that two natural substances can target and remove aging and senile cells. And that's important, because that helps prevent cancer from those cells. And this is one of those is quercetin, Eat an onion, quercetin. Eat an apple skin, quercetin. Take a supplement, 1,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day, quercetin. Quercetin, Q-U-E-R, quercetin, C-I-T-I-N. Quercetin, and as well as the tocotrienols, which are a form of vitamin E, rid the body of the aging cells that are a major cause of chronic inflammation and disease, while simultaneously promoting the health and growth of normal cells. And therefore, you're not triggering senescence at the cellular level, which can also cause cancer. Remember, when old cells in your body stop dividing, they stop creating new cells. And these obsolete old cells lose the ability to die off. That's a condition called cellular senescence. And senescent cells then accumulate in the body, emitting pro-inflammatory chemicals, promoting aging, and increasing cancer risk. So tocotrienols, a form of vitamin E, and quercetin help block that process. So that's good, way of protecting ourselves. And eating healthy oils, our final comment today, we know that for cardiovascular patients, they generally are not instructed what are the healthiest oils to eat. Well, your healthiest oil would be flaxseed oil and hemp seed oil and cod liver oil and the omega-3 fatty acids and coconut oil. Those are your healthy oils. Eating avocado, very good for you. And according to this latest research from Sao Paulo University in Brazil, it can turn off inflammation, which causes atherosclerosis, where artery walls become thickened with deposits of fatty plaque. And during inflammation, the body produces molecules like, you've heard me mention, C-reactive protein, or CRP, and interleukins. Well, previous research suggested the C-reactive protein is by itself an independent predictor of cardiovascular disease, while the interleukins 1B, 6, 8, 10, and 12 are used also for inflammation. So when you're taking these short-chain omega-3 fatty acids, it can turn off inflammation. So take the healthy oils and help the heart. That's the latest on health and healing. We're halfway through our program. In a moment, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with my guest. In fact, I want to play the George Carlin thing before we go to our guest, and then we'll have our guest for the remainder of the program. But I just want to mention that tomorrow I'll be having something new. I'm altering our health support group to spreading out over 4 weeks, 4 Saturdays from 3 to 6, about 3 hours long, where people can watch a documentary, part of it. I'm going to answer questions, but there's so many people who have so many questions that I can't answer people's questions, and I only personally meet each day and counsel terminally ill people. After all, just be reasonable. If a person has been told they've got 3 weeks to live and someone else has got an ingrown toenail and they're both going to take me the same amount of time to help, I'm going to help the person whose life is most at risk. So what I've done, however, is in the 4 topics I'm starting with, I'm going to answer as many questions and as many protocols as possible. Tomorrow I'm starting with "It's Not Your Fault, You're Fat." And why all these crash diets and high-protein diets and much of the information out there is just wrong. So what do you have to do to get rid of the weight in a safe and healthy way, actually get healthier in the process and help ourselves lower blood pressure, lower triglycerides, improve our overall well-being? That's tomorrow. Next week it's menopause, slowing down and reversing menopause. And the week after that it's arthritis, the week after that it's diabetes. So that's the next 4. Now that's all I have time for this year. So because the rest of the year is very booked. But at least if you think about how many people have depression, diabetes, or overweight, high blood pressure, all going together. So a lot of people can be helped. Go to GaryNall.com. You'll see how to sign up for tomorrow until we're full. And I was told about 10 minutes before we started our program day, we're about full. And once we're full, that's it. We've maximized our bandwidth. Or you can call 646-926-5422 if you need any more help or information on that. And if you need to listen by telephone any day of the week, Monday to Friday, here's a number to call if you're not near a radio or not near a computer. If you need to reach the show any day of the week, call 712 775-6850, 712-775-6850. If you miss a show, you're just busy, which many people are, and can't listen live, then you can go to the archive anytime, 24/7. You can download 5 different programs by calling 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. So that's what's coming up. A whole lot of good, helping a lot of people live a longer and healthier life. We're going to take a break. Come back with George Carlin. Please stay with us.
I really haven't seen this many people in one place since they took the group photographs of all the criminals and lawbreakers in the Ronald Reagan administration. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. 225 of them so far. 225 different people in the Ronald Reagan administration have either quit, been fired, been arrested, indicted, or convicted of either breaking the law or violating the ethics code. 225 of them. And Edwin Meese alone has been investigated by 3 separate special prosecutors, and there's a 4th one waiting for him in Washington right now. 3 separate special prosecutors have had to look into the activities of the Attorney General. And the Attorney General is the nation's leading law enforcement officer. See, that's what you got to remember. This is the Ronald Reagan administration we're talking about. These are the law and order people. These are the people who are against street crime. They want to put street criminals in jail to make life safer for the business criminals. They're against street crime. Yeah, they're against street crime, providing that street isn't Wall Street. And the Supreme Court decided about a year ago that it's all right to put people in jail now if we just think they're going to commit a crime. It's called preventive detention. All you've got to do now is just think they're going to commit a crime. Well, if we'd have known 7 or 8 years ago, we could have put a bunch of these Republicans directly into prison. Put them in the joint where they belong, and we could have saved the money of putting these country club pinheads on trial. Another thing you got to remember, this is the group of people who were elected with the help of the moral majority. Elected with the help of the moral
majority. The Democrats don't, and liberals don't get too excited by his condemnation of Republicans. He's equally tart and insightful about Democrats, but that'll be for another show. Now we're going to go to our guest who is standing by. In the Netherlands, I gave you about his background a little earlier, and he is also the author of The New Deal, A Global History, and it's been recognized as a tour de force volume on a little-known aspect of the New Deal's international impact, and he is Professor Kiram Klaus Patel. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Americans, especially liberals and progressives, look back at FDR's New Deal following the Great Depression as a watershed and landmark movement that ushered in a kind of golden age for America. We look back at some of the domestic policies today and how it improved the life of many Americans. And if FDA's Glass-Steagall Act had remained in place without being gutted by Bill and Hillary Clinton before they left office, the mortgage bubble debacle and recession of 2008 may not have occurred at all, or at least would not have been so severe. And what very few people know is that the New Deal had huge international implications and set a trajectory for American expansionism, its self-image of exceptionalism among nations, and military adventurism overseas that led us to the belief that we are the sole superpower. And of course, this legacy has had both beneficial and dire consequences during the past 60 years. And today, there is much criticism about the U.S.'s exceptionalism and the advent of corporate capitalism and the American domination over the global economy through multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and that were founded around FDR. So first, briefly define what the New Deal was for any listeners who are not familiar with it, and then please take your time and share with us what you believe were the most salient features of the New Deal's international and foreign policies and strategies that have had the greatest impact on the role the U.S. has had in the world today. The forum is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. First, on the definition, that has been a question ever since the New Deal started. What actually was there to define it? And there is a lot of research that shows that there wasn't a consistent philosophy that was driving the New Deal. Some people say, well, this was a rather Keynesian policy when it comes to the economy. Others say that it is about state intervention. But again, if you look at the details of the program, one will quickly realize that they were driven by very different economic concepts, that also the notion of society was quite kind of different across the various parts of the New Deal alphabet. All these various agencies that came into being during the period of Roosevelt's presidency. Having said that, I would argue that there were things that changed markedly with the New Deal and in the New Deal, and that is particularly the relationship between citizens and the federal state. Up to the point of the New Deal, the federal state was basically absent in the life of most Americans. Yes, there was the post office. Yes, there were discussions about some taxes. But in the everyday life, the federal state was basically absent. That really changed with the New Deal. And there was, of course, a stronger way of interacting and also impacting on people's lives with all these agencies that were created, from work creation over Social Security on to agriculture policies, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and all these other agencies. And I argue in my book that this was very much driven by the kind of crisis America was facing, the Great Depression that started in 1929, and against which Americans were looking for new answers to overcome the crisis, which then basically played out as the New Deal. Now, on the second question, the international dimensions, I think it's important to remind ourselves that in the first years of Roosevelt's presidency after 1933, there was a real inward turn. So there wasn't very much of international commitment. Some of the rhetoric, even of the president himself, might even remind of President Trump by arguing that America had to come first, that economic recovery in the United States should have precedent over any form of international commitment. We have to contextualize these sources. Roosevelt himself was an kind of committed internationalist. In a 1928 Foreign Affairs article, he had even argued that the U.S. should join the League of Nations, which is, if you will, the predecessor of today's United Nations and a highly controversial organization at the time. But once in power, he realized that domestic resistance against any kind of international programs were very strong, and therefore he prioritized national recovery. It was only in the second half of the 1930s that all these international commitments started to become more important, and it only was during World War II that they were really then established. And that holds particularly true if you talk about the Bretton Woods organizations, the World Bank, and so on, that you mentioned already, for the very tail end of the Roosevelt presidency that ended with his death in 1945. I think it is, if you want to summarize this period, the international commitment with all its kind of beneficial and also problematic dimensions was the result of a long learning curve in the course of the 1930s that this more nation-centered policy approach that the New Dealers tried out first only led them to some solutions, and that given the international crisis the world was heading into, there was the need for more international commitment. And then there was also this new vision of an American mission and goal of sharing certain accomplishments as the New Dealers saw them that they wanted to then project on the world.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. One of the important aspects I found in your work is that the New Deal cannot be accurately understood in isolation from other nations that we were trying to emerge out of, and these nations were also in catastrophic mode because of the Great Depression, even if not the Second World War. And this meant many countries were experimenting with different modes of governance and reorganizing their economic structures to rebuild themselves. And there was a certain kind of regimentation that FDR instituted in New Deal policies and programs that was not too dissimilar to what Hitler's political party was doing in Germany. For example, FDR's Civilian Conservation Corps to increase job training and employment. So could you take it from there and give us a broader perspective?
Sure, happy to. Again, this is one of the key arguments of the book, that exceptionalism, the idea that the United States and its history is fundamentally different from that of any other country, is highly problematic, and I think it's wrong. And that this book for this period in history shows very much how much efforts in the United States to kind of overcome the Great Depression shared similarities with policies in other countries, and secondly, that they were also highly informed by policies in other places. Why? In the 1920s, you had a rather successful, at least at first glance, American economic model, and one where many Americans felt that they had overcome earlier crises and that there was a capitalist, democratic model of organizing society that worked. That, again, also was a model for the world. But the Great Depression from 1929 put that idea under a great stress. And America was probably the elites, but also other people, as desperate as people in other parts of the world, facing high unemployment rates and economic downturn and political instability to some extent, to find new solutions. And hence, there was an intense search for what other countries were doing, what one could learn from them. It's important to add that this search for new political answers was not meant to cooperate. It was rather to find models to improve the national level of policymaking. So in that sense, there was a nation-centered approach of international cooperation and of transnational discussions and conversations going on there. And I would argue that this was really a moment in U.S.-American history where Americans were really looking out, particularly to European societies, to see what they could learn. Again, not as one-to-one copies, but in piecemeal adaptation processes. And it's right to say that they even didn't stop kind of at this difference between democracy and dictatorship. It was the president of the United States himself, Franklin Roosevelt, who a few years before World War II started, even sent people in the U.S. Embassy in Berlin out to write reports about Nazi social and economic policies, not to learn or not to see what the enemy, the future enemy, would do, but really to see if there was anything to be learned for domestic purposes. He himself thanked for one of these reports by saying, and here I quote him, "All of this helps us in planning, even though our methods are of the democratic variety." So in that sense, there was the idea that there was a technical level of expertise that one could distract also from the ideological dimensions of policymaking in dictatorships like Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, the Soviet Union, one could learn from without, again, also embracing the ideological implications of these policies. And in another book I've written, I have compared the Civilian Conservation Corps with a somewhat similar organization in Nazi Germany. And there I argue that, yes, there were important similarities, but one should also not forget the differences, that the level of anti-Semitism, of aggressive imperialist policies that also was part of the DNA of that Nazi organization had no equivalent in the New Deal. There was discrimination of African Americans. It was not open to everybody to the same extent. It was male-centered, white, working-class people who profited most. But still, there was a marked difference also from what the Nazis did in Germany, while at the same time, I argue that these organizations also shared important things, particularly the idea that the state, the federal state, now finally took care of people. So the whole idea of mobilizing society, of at least creating symbols of state action and of a powerful state that cared for people, is something that a rather abstract level combines and kind of is very similar in these two societies.
I'd like to ask you one last question, going further on what you just discussed, because today the New Deal is a lost dream. And since then, the Democratic Party has morphed into what the Republican Party was decades ago, as pro-business, even favoring privatization in social services. And then we have to ask, what do we believe were the main signals or signs that brought about the end of the New Deal as a social and political movement? And also, before FDR, African Americans and minorities were loyal to the Republican Party, which was viewed as the party of Lincoln. And FDR won over the black vote, and since then, it's been loyal to the Democratic Party, which I believe has betrayed them. In fact, most of the, virtually all the progressive blacks I know, you know, let's say the people who support and read Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey and Bruce Dixon and so many others, also view the Democratic Party as being corporatized. And what have you observed on some of the racial issues inherent in the New Deal and its developers and the kind of subtle white superiority you just mentioned? And this was also right. somewhat related to the earlier eugenics movement that took hold among American intellectuals and eventually spread to Germany, where it influenced Hitler's doctors and psychiatrists. And somewhat were this is a very disturbing racial element of the New Deal that is never discussed. Your final thoughts, please.
I discussed that a little bit in my book, and there is other research that has argued that there was a white bias in New Deal social policies. Ira Katznelson, with his new book, Fear Itself, and also his earlier work, When Affirmative Action Was White, this is one of his provocative book titles, has made that case that, again, the kind of welfare state that the New Deal has built was mainly male, it was white, and it was kind of industrial working class, which also didn't bring the same kind of support for people in agriculture, for instance. There was, again, the gender and the racial dimension also. So in that sense, I think there is a problematic dimension in the New Deal, even if there were so many positive aspects. And talking about the parties, I think this is a very long conversation that also historians have had about the rise and particularly then the fall of the New Deal order. There is a book that was edited some 25 years ago on that very issue, and there was a conference in Santa Barbara a few years ago that revisited that book and really brought up that question again: when and how did the New Deal order actually end? And if there's one way of summarizing it, it's probably to say, well, it's so difficult to summarize because it really depends on the specific question that you want to discuss. Of course, with Ronald Reagan, with the 1980s, you see a lot of dismantling of these kind of policies. And it is not only the Democrats, obviously, it's also the Republicans. And of course, if you talk about the lost dreams, if you will, of African-Americans, of activists, there is a problem in the Democratic Party, but it's, of course, also that the Republicans offer no alternative at all. And in a system that is strongly kind of based on two parties, there is a problem with not having an alternative in that sense. So yeah. I would argue that the fall and the dismantling of the New Deal started with Gary Goldwater in the 1960s, with also new dimensions in the Republican Party with the rise of Ronald Reagan. But I would also argue and agree with you that on some issues, Clinton's government and also other Democratic presidents have also done a lot to dismantle some parts of the element of the New Deal order. And when it comes to banking regulation, I see we have seen the consequences of this more neoliberal take that also the Republicans have embraced in the last economic crisis. And I fear that what has been created in the past 10 years isn't safe enough to prevent another crisis of this kind.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you very much for being on today, Professor Kieran Klaus Patel, P-A-T-E-L, from the Netherlands, author of The New Deal.
Thank you so much.
For Global History.
Right.
Now, I want to finish our program today by addressing, I think I'll only have time for one of these. This is from Claire from Detroit. Gary, I heard one of your shows where you're talking about some of the feminists that have been important inspirations, and you pointed them out, but I was not able to hear all of them. I didn't take it down. Could you relist some of the people that you felt were important, and not just feminist, but also the other women as well? I would say that for me, if I look back at all the women that, and there have been many, that I believe have made major contributions to society, at the top of my list, and this is not an easy list because they're so equal in so many ways, but the one that gets very little attention is Madame Curie. Why? Because when she was doing her work, she was very much alone. Her husband initially, who was a chairman of a department and professor at the Sorbonne, they both won Nobel Prizes. By the way, she was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize. She actually won two Nobel Prizes. No woman in history has won two Nobel Prizes, one in physics and one in chemistry. And she also was the discoverer of radium, which provided men like Ernst Rutherford with sources of radioactivity, which they could use in this, creating the structure, understanding the structure of the atom. And that helped overturn all of the previously established laws of physics and chemistry on that. And radium's radioactivity was so great that it could not be ignored, and it seemed to contradict the principle of conservation of energy and therefore forced a reconsideration of the foundations of physics. And to obtain her scientific achievement, she had to overcome barriers that were placed in her way because she was a woman. And they intentionally refrained from patenting the radium isolation process because her and her husband said that this should be a gift to the entire world to help heal cancer. So she gave this. Could you imagine someone today having what would be a multi-billion dollar patent and giving it, even though they were not rich? They lived very meager lives. And she refused money. She refused to sell out. In fact, when she met, I believe she met at least on one occasion, prior to winning the Nobel Prize, she met Albert Einstein, who was a young person. We're talking about around 2005 now, when she was in her late 20s. I think she was 29 or 30 when she won the Nobel Prize. Albert Einstein let everyone know that he found her the smartest woman he'd ever met in his life, and because she could not be corrupted by fame. In fact, the money that she got for her Nobel Prizes, she gave to the scientific community so that they could continue their research. She gave to students. She really was against awards and medals. She was extremely humble. And she lived a rather solitary life after her husband died. Yet she had a long career. I'm not sure, but I think her daughter also won a Nobel Prize. So when you put it in context, she was the first woman ever nominated for a professorship in Europe, or in France, which allowed no women to be professors. And she was allowed to teach at the Sorbonne, but she wasn't given a professorship. And then the French Academy of Sciences, which is equivalent to the Royal Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, her husband was a ranking member. She was nominated but was not allowed because of bias, just misogyny. So I look at all the wonderful women who've made such magnificent achievements, and there have been many. And this was at the time when you had great minds, the Impressionist movement of the 19th century that characterized a relatively small, thin, yet visible brushstrokes, open composition, emphasis on accurate depiction of light and its changing qualities. You had Oscar Claude Monet and Vincent Willem van Gogh, major post-impressionist painter. He was a Dutch artist, and Edgar Degas, and the French artist famous for his paintings, sculptures, and prints, and Henri Gauguin, and Paul Cézanne, and even the symbolism movement at the time, They were all, she knew all these people. They were all friends, most of them. Gustav Klimt, the Austrian symbolist painter, and Edward Munch, Frida Kahlo de Rivera, the famous Mexican painter, best known for self-portraits and living down Mexico City, and Gustave Moreau, the French symbolist. Imagine having all these great artists who were doing revolutionary work, including Picasso, and great scientific minds and great literary minds, all in the same environment. And then you get an idea of what it would be like to be in that. And I also don't want to leave out Jane Goodall, a primatologist, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, Dorothy Day, Nina Simone, Rachel Carson, Virginia Woolf, one of the greatest novelists of the 20th century, Maria Stopes, the British paleontologist, botanist, Agatha Christie. By the way, most people are not aware, she is the third most selling author in history. I think maybe the author of the Harry Potter series may have sold more now, but until then, only the Bible and Shakespeare had sold more books. She was one of the most talented, translated, best-selling female authors in world history. Dorothy Hodgkin, Nobel Prize-winning scientist for her work on structure B12. Catherine Hepburn, a great, outspoken artist, broke all the rules. Janet Lane Clapton, epidemiologist. Allison Hargreaves, mountaineer. She was the first woman, by the way, to climb Mount Everest alone without oxygen. Or without oxygen and alone. She died, by the way, when she tried to climb K2, one of the world's most inhospitable mountains. Rosalind Franklin, a scientist. She's the unsung hero of DNA. We all know about Francis Crick and James Watson. We don't know that they couldn't have done what they did unless they used her work. She was the unsung hero of DNA. Franklin's X-ray images, the double helix, provided the data that Francis Crick and James Watson used to make their hypothesis on its structure. And she died at 37, very young, just 4 years before the Nobel Prize was claimed by her contemporaries. And Helen Bamber, Iris Murdoch, the novelist and philosopher, Miriam Rothschild. So we have had so many wonderful women, you know, and trying to say which one contributed the most is not really a possibility because they all contributed unique insights, unique contributions in their own time, and therefore it'd be like looking up in heaven and seeing 10,000 angels. Which one is the most warm-hearted? They all are. They're all just precious to our memory of history, and therefore I commend all great women of the 20th century and before and since. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.